don't we often say that, oh, our country is so diverse, so complex, so complicated, there isn't one like that, right? Now, what I realize increasingly, as even for Cut the Clutter, I read up more and more on the rest of the world, that actually we flatter ourselves. Because there is no part of the world which does not have massive complexities. It is just that because we live where we live, this is more important for us, we just happen to know more about this. Because the moment you delve into what's happening elsewhere, you find layers upon layers upon layers, and you say, oh, looks like my country is simpler compared to this. Now, I'm talking about Europe, because Russia's invasion of Ukraine has made us focus on Europe as we haven't done in decades, if at all. We might have focused on Britain, maybe a little bit on France, but Europe, no, not really. Although all of Europe's map, all of Europe's geostrategy, geopolitics got redefined after the end of the Cold War. New states came in, old states vanished, all that we know, but we never paid great attention to it. But now we are doing it. And I am discovering so much that I never knew. Today, the context is very simple, one, a very newsy context, that Sweden and Finland together have applied to join NATO. Okay, simple enough, we know that Sweden and Finland are close neighbors of Russia, of Russian Federation. Russia is going to be very insecure about it, and already Russia has begun to make noise and protesting, even saying there will be consequences, we will retaliate in a manner of our choosing, in time of our choosing. And they've been holding out threats. So that is normal. We know that. We also know that Finland and Russia, Soviet Union then, had the so-called Winter War between 1939-40, where Finland fought a rear guard using snipers, inflicted lots of casualties on the Soviets. And Sweden since then has remained neutral, and has also generally been, until about 30 years back, 35 years back, has been under Soviet influence. So that was the process that was called Finlandization. Now, that was important for Russia, because that way these two European countries, which are more inclined towards the West, culturally, politically, ideologically, but were Russia's next door neighbors, territorial neighbors, Russia was able to keep some hold over them, and Sweden also similarly had remained neutral. So we can see why the Russians are getting neurotic that these two countries have applied for NATO membership. But see how reactions have come up from elsewhere. So Erdogan, Turkey. Now Erdogan is a kind of character where you expect that anytime anything's happening, any place, he will do something to grab a headline, because he's a headline hunter. A champion one, sometimes at his country's cost as well. So he is the usual suspect. But in this case, some interesting stuff has also come out of, say, a country like Croatia. Now, who would have imagined trouble coming up from Croatia? When was the last time we in India, I know many of you must be experts, particularly who are preparing for UPSC, etc., etc. You can tell me the entire history of the breakup of the Balkans and what happened to former Yugoslavia, former Czechoslovakia, etc., etc. So I'm not arguing with you. But the fact is that by and large, we have very little idea or very little memory now of what happened in that region, except maybe that there was a lot of fighting. Particularly in Bosnia, there were Bosnian massacres mostly were of Muslim citizens, etc., etc. And what used to be one big powerful republic under Marshal Tito, Marshal Josip Broz Tito, under whose name a main avenue is still named in Delhi. In fact, I don't live very far from it. I live closer to the part that's called Jamal Abdul Nasir Road. These are sections of the Ring Road. Josip Broz Tito Road, on the other hand, connects Ring Road, comes towards central Delhi. In fact, that is where, under Sheila Dikshit, Congress government in Delhi had carried out its big disaster of what was called as bus rapid transport. Anyway, let's not get digressed. So, Tito's republic broke and many republics came up. Croatia, out of those, there was Croatia, there was Serbia, there was Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, Croatia is a member of NATO. The law in NATO is that, or the rules or the norms in NATO are that any time you have to admit a new member, you have to have all the existing members agree. Even if one disagrees, you cannot take a new member. So any existing member, every existing member, that's 30 of them, they have a right of veto. Or what would, for all practical purposes, be a right of veto? So what has happened now is that, first of all, Turkey has jumped in. You would expect Erdogan to jump in, as I had said. So Erdogan is saying, look, I have no problem. Sweden, Finland, they want to come into NATO. They can come into NATO. But what is NATO? NATO is about shared security. That means your security is mine. Something happens to you, anybody attacks you, all of us will come to your defense. That is what NATO is, which means all 30 countries under NATO, their territory is to be defended by the entire NATO. So the attack on one will be an attack on all. That's the reason Ukraine has been wanting to join NATO, and that's the reason Russia has been so upset about it. Now, listen to Erdogan's argument. Erdogan says, if NATO is about shared security, right, then how come my security threats are not being taken seriously? My, as in Turkey's security threats. What are his security threats? Besides everything else, his immediate security threat is the Kurdish population, which has been fighting his armed forces. Now, these are Kurds in Syria. These are Kurds, also Turkish Kurds, Syrian Kurds. Also, then there are Kurds in neighboring countries, there are Kurds in Iraq, for example, in Iran. Kurds are a large community. The total number of Kurds, in fact, in the world is more than 4 crore. So 4 crore in that geography is a lot of population. Now 4 crores, they are divided between Iraq, Syria, Turkey and Iran. And many have gone as refugees or settlers, migrants elsewhere. Germany, for example, has about 2 lakh Kurds. Sweden itself, a small country with a population of just about a crore, has almost a lakh of Kurds. So Kurds have spread out because they've been fighting for their own homeland. And these three countries are powerful countries in their own ways. And look at the population of these countries. Iraq is 3.85 crores. That means the total population of Kurds in all these neighboring countries together is more than the population of Iraq. If it's more than the population of Iraq, it's more than twice as much as the population of Syria. So Syria is 1.75 crores, right? I'm not even sure whether this is a count including the refugees, because given how many Syrian refugees have gone out of the country, the actual count on the ground in Syria would be maybe 2 or 3 million less than these. So Iraq, 3.85 crores, Syria, 1.75 crores, Turkey, 8.5 crores, Iran, 8.4 crores. So these two are the largest countries in the region, but Kurds again are half the population of these. Now there are two groups among Kurds. So PKK is essentially Kurdish Workers Party. So PKK originally stands for Partia Karkeren Kurdistan, right? So Party of the Workers of Kurdistan. But it took up arms. It is also listed as a terrorist organization by many countries, including the US and EU. In fact, the EU Parliament at one point had said that they had been unnecessarily, unfairly called a terrorist organization, but EU has still kept them on the list of terrorist organizations. So PKK is what threatens Turkey from within, or Erdogan from within. Then there is YPG. Now YPG, or People's Protection Units, again the original name, Yekiniyen Parastina Jel. This is composed of Syrian Kurds. Syrian Kurds with a few other volunteers, etc. And it's a very messed up area because sometimes you don't know who's fighting whom and who's fighting alongside whom, against whom. And these lines cross all the time. Now, if you look at YPG, YPG has been fighting, he's been the preeminent group fighting Islamic State in that area, right? In fact, without YPG being in front, Raqqa, which was the capital of Islamic State, would have never been liberated. So YPG fought against Islamic State, helped liberate Raqqa, and then they were supported by the US, by the US air power, US air forces, air force and other assets. Also, all the assets of what is known as Combined Joint Task Force, US-led Combined Joint Task Force, carrying out Operation Inherent Resolve. So YPG was the front runner in that operation.
YPG at the same time has been fighting the Turkish army. So they've been fighting ISIL, that is Islamic State of Iraq and Levant. ISIL, or now IS, is what is popularly used. Syrian rebels, Turkish army, all at the same time, they liberated Raqqa. But the Turkish got so insecure about that Erdogan launched his own attack against them. So Erdogan is a NATO ally of the Americans. Americans are allied with YPG. But Erdogan is fighting with YPG in partnership with groups he is friendly with in Syria. So this is a perfect dog's breakfast. Now, what he sees as rebels, what he sees as insurgents or a grave threat to his country, are also seen as freedom fighters by many others. And then you have this complication of Scandinavian countries or Nordic countries, as these are called. What are the Nordic countries? Nordic means northern countries. So these are countries of North Europe. There are five of them. Again, something that we are not always conscious of. The five Nordic countries are Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway, and little Iceland. Little Iceland with a population of just over 3 lakh people. Now, if you combine all these populations of these five countries in Northern Europe or Nordic countries, the combined population is just about 2.7 crore. Just about 2.7 crore. That's just a little bit more than the population of Delhi. That's these five countries. But if you take their combined GDP is about half the total GDP of India. So a population which is about 2% of the population of India in these five Nordic countries has GDP of 1366 billion or $1.366 trillion, which is a little less than just about half of India's GDP. So that tells you that these are very rich, wealthy countries also. Now, these countries also, they have among the highest rankings on Global Happiness Index. But besides that, these countries also have very liberal laws on immigration, which means anybody who wants to seek asylum but faces a death penalty in their own countries will be given asylum, say in a country like Sweden. And I have to tell you a very interesting story about that. If I forget, please remind me. Towards the end of this episode, I will tell you that story. So 33 of these Kurdish rebels, mostly of PKK, 33 of these most wanted Kurdish rebels have taken refuge in Sweden. And under Sweden's own liberal laws, they can't hand them over to Turkey because they will face the death sentence there. Also, they will face all kinds of other horrible consequences because, you know, Erdogan runs one kind of government, Sweden runs another kind of government. So now Erdogan is saying that, look, if NATO means common security, then what's a security threat to me should also be a security threat to you. So if you're not even returning to me people who I consider to be security threats to me, how can I let you join the same security alliance in which I'm a leading partner? Turkey, by the way, has the second largest armed forces in NATO. Turkey is a large country. So, and Turkey has a military history. So Turkey is very important in NATO. Turkey also is the Asian edge of NATO. Asian edge, it sits geostrategically in a very important position. Nobody can wish Turkey away. So Anthony Blinken, US Secretary of State, has now said that, oh, we'll find a way around it. But the fact is, everybody looks for leverage in global diplomacy. We keep saying all the time, every country works in its supreme national interest. And Erdogan now thinks that he can get some bargain out of it. So we are back to that old Punjabi truism or Punjabi sort of metaphor of wisdom, which is that all those who go to the funeral of somebody who died in someone else's family and are crying there are crying for their own dead. They are not crying for your dead. They might pretend that they're crying for your dead, but they're crying for their own dead. He says, look, NATO never supported Turkey against the Kurds. And he says, and this is a quote from him, we have such a sensitivity as protecting our borders from attacks by terror organizations, because PKK and YPG for him are terror organizations. He also has the followers of Fethullah Gulen, who he accuses of having masterminded the coup attempt in 2016. And he thinks that his followers are also given refuge by these Scandinavian countries. So he wants them in also. And he says, look, NATO expansion must keep in mind our security sensitivities. And he's really turning the knife. So Erdogan says, and I quote him from a Reuters story, "So you won't give us back our own terrorists, but you ask for NATO membership. NATO is an entity for security, an organization for security. Therefore, we cannot say yes to this security organization being deprived of our own security." So he's really turning the knife or upping the ante, you can choose the expression. His chief foreign policy advisor, that is Ibrahim Kalin, he has also repeated the same thing, and he's also said that, look, when we were fighting YPG in Syria, none of you guys helped us. So YPG in Syria, the other Kurdish group, Turkey got so worried about them that they actually captured a fair bit of area in northern or northeastern Syria and tried to create a Turkish enclave there by settling a million Turks, a million people of Turkish origin there. That the Western world, that the other NATO members did not support. In fact, they opposed it. And that is what they are complaining about. So that is where Erdogan is coming from. Plus, he has other grievances. So he says, look, so many of these European countries, EU countries, fellow NATO countries have also put sanctions against me, that is against Turkey, because of human rights and this and that. He also says that, he doesn't say it, but he indicates it, that EU has kept him out because he wanted to become a member of EU, but he done, his laws do not pass, his laws and conduct do not pass the test of the human rights standards that EU sets, essentially, or the quality of his democracy. Those are reasons that EU has not admitted him. He really wants it, although just a few percentage points of his territory happens to fall under Europe, but he really wants it. So EU has kept him out. So he says, why do you want me to keep accommodating you? And he says also, or his people say, that the import of F-35 has been blocked for him because he bought Russian S-400 missiles. Also, he wants a fresh lot of F-16s, latest F-16s, to refurbish his fleet, and that is being denied. So he is making his own demands, and it's being quite transparent and straightforward. In fact, that's the way business is done in that part of the world. So he's just being a transactional leader, and why should it not be? Now, just like him, look at the leaders of Croatia. Croatia has its own issues. First of all, Croatia still has a lot of connections with the Russians. Russian social media, Russian propaganda is very strong there. Croatia also has an issue between their president and their prime minister and their parliament. So Croatian president it is who's taken the lead in opposing this NATO entry by Finland and Sweden. And he has said that they will also veto it. But he's not vetoing it. He's saying that I am advising my parliament to take a call on this and veto it. His prime minister, on the other hand, says, nonsense. You are so powerful. You are the president. You want to veto it? Veto it. Why are you passing the buck on to parliament? So again, there is some leverage being exercised there because the Croats also want something in the process from this bargain. So Croat president, that is Zoran Milanovic, he says that, look, I was not elected. In fact, his exact quote is, I was elected to be Croatian president, not a cosmopolitan moralist. So once again, in other words, in sort of more flowery words, he's saying what we keep saying, that every country watches its own interest first and morality and the rest later. His view on Russia has generally been, initially it was that all that was being said of Russia's human rights abuses in Ukraine, etc., was propaganda. But lately he's been saying that, look, these may be true because a lot of evidence is now coming out. But what are the Russians? Russians are very dangerous people. You can't take pangas with them because you get Putin angry. God knows what will happen. So he's saying that I'm not going anywhere near letting Finland and Sweden come into NATO unless electoral laws are changed in tiny Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, what is the issue with Bosnia-Herzegovina? It's a tiny country of just less than 4 million people, but it's also a country of mixed ethnicities. So he says, and that's also the Croat view, Croatian view, that electoral laws in Bosnia-Herzegovina are such that Croats don't have sufficient power there, that electoral laws there favor Bosniaks or the original Bosnian ethnicity. Now, again, tiny Bosnia-Herzegovina, it may be a population of less than 4 million people, just about 4 million people, but they have their own complexity. So next time we again complain about complexities in our country, we have to remember what's happening there. So if you look at the Bosniaks, which are the dominant power, they are just a tiny majority. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, they are 50.1% of the population. That's all. Then Serbs are 30.8% and Croats are 15.4%. And again, if you want to see more diversity, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, 50.7% are Muslim. So essentially, the Muslim population and the Bosniak population is the same number. And 48% are Christian. Christians also in different denominations, Orthodox and Catholic. So diversity. Diversity can be strength. Diversity can be a problem, a weakness. And that's where when we look at India all the time, we have to say, fantastic. We are more diverse than anybody and larger than anybody. And yet we are together. Little Bosnia with 36 lakh, 37 lakh people is not able to handle it. And they have laws that militated against the interests of Croats as Croatia sees it. Now, Bosnia-Herzegovina is not a member of NATO. So how does Croatia expect that somebody can make them change their laws? That's because this rearrangement of the Balkans came up as a result of the Dayton agreements. In Dayton agreements, when Bosnia-Herzegovina was carved out, it was put under the charge of somebody who might be called a governor general or a viceroy in terms that we are familiar with in India. So Bosnia-Herzegovina, the chief executive in a way is not the elected chief executive, although it has a liberal parliamentary system. Chief executive is called High Representative for Bosnia and Herzegovina. Now, High Representative is not a native. Today, that High Representative is from Germany, Christian Schmidt, who is a German politician. So once again, the Croats expect that since international community, particularly Europeans and the Americans, have leverage over Bosnia, they can use that leverage to get Bosnia-Herzegovina to change these laws. So how is this for complexities among small countries, small populations in distant, faraway parts of the world that we almost never care to think about? But remember, in a globalized world, everything is interlinked. So if Finland and Sweden have to come into NATO, then somebody has to take a call on those 33 asylees, Kurdish asylees in Sweden. And somebody also worry about internal electoral laws in Bosnia-Herzegovina, a country of just 36, 37 lakh people. Now, because I promised to tell you a story about Swedish laws, I will just tell you. So this was probably sometime in 1983 or 1984 that I got a call from this political counselor in the Swedish embassy in Delhi. And he called me and he said, look, I'm so and so. I'm calling you because of all of us read you. You covered Punjab very closely, terrorism in Punjab very closely. We have an institution called the Nordic Lunch where senior diplomats of Nordic countries, all Nordic countries, meet once a month and we invite somebody to talk to us. Can you come and talk to us? So I said, sure. At that point, this is 1983 or 84, I wasn't even so aware of the Nordic countries. I know that there was something called Nordic countries, but I didn't particularly understand. So I went to see them. There at lunch, they asked me if I knew, if I was familiar with the name of a Sikh alleged terrorist. So I said, look, a lot of the names look familiar and a lot of people, particularly in Punjab among the Sikhs, seem to have the same name. So it's very difficult for me to say. So they said that, look, this person says that he blew up a bridge or a culvert that destroyed a police bus going over it. And in that incident, many policemen got killed and Indian police wants him in connection with that case. Can you please check for us? Can you please find out if you are not familiar, if what that guy is saying is the truth? So I said, listen, I don't know. And why should I tell you? Even if what he's saying is the truth or not, it's not my concern. It's for your law to deal with him. If he was in India, Indian law would deal with him. But your law, who am I to tell you sitting a distance away? And moreover, so suppose I told you from my cursory knowledge that yes, there was an incident like this, and there was an incident like that, in fact. And a person by that name was wanted in that incident. So this guy is telling you the truth. In that case, without concrete knowledge, I'll be giving him away. I'll be giving away a human being and a fellow Indian away. So your law will treat him very rudely. So that is when these diplomats will be, no. In fact, if you said to us that he's innocent, that you've never heard of someone like him having carried out a terror attack, that will be very bad for him. That might be very bad for him because then we'll extradite him to India. I said, what kind of nonsense is this? If I tell you that he's innocent, you will extradite him to India. But if I say that he is a terrorist, you will keep him there. They said, no. That's because if he actually carried out a bomb attack, he blew up a bridge, that blew up a police bus in which a lot of policemen were killed. If he comes back to India and is put on trial, then he will be liable to get death penalty. And under our law, we have to give asylum to anybody who faces death penalty for whatever their crime back home in their native country. So this was, I came back thinking, ulti ganga beh rahi hai, right? This is completely the opposite of what I would have thought. So that is how these Scandinavian countries work. And these are complexities we need to understand. And that's the complexity, as you can see now, that Erdogan refuses to accept.